This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to another spotlight. Israel's most recent genocidal war on Gaza failed to secure its stated goals. This is something that has been happening several times in the past decades, and every time the lessons are never learned. We can see that Israel had to resort to negotiations and concessions, and those concessions even are not equal terms. Three captives released in return for nearly 100 on day one. 100 Palestinian prisoners, some of them serving life sentences in Israel, some of them war heroes in Gaza. Allow me to introduce my guest in this episode of our Spotlight. My name is Bahman Nurai, your host. Leith Maruf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. And Sakina Datu, author, journalist and producer, joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Very good to have you on the program. I'm going to start with Sakina. What were the stated goals of Israel? All of them failed.
Absolutely. I mean, each and every goal that Israel had going for this war failed completely. At the start of it, they were very, very clear about the whole war being to release their hostages. And we saw that they weren't able to release any of them. When they tried, they actually ended up killing some of their own hostages. And every time a hostage has been released, it has been through diplomacy or through negotiations. So on that front, they completely failed. But also they failed because they wanted to break the resilience of the Palestinian people, and they wanted to break the resistance in the region, both in Lebanon and also in Gaza. And today when we see all this jubilation, for a former people who have suffered, who have had family members died, whose homes have been bombed, but they are celebrating today. This is a celebration of victory, which tells us that Israel was not successful on any count. And really, the Palestinian people's resistance has come forth. And so definitely none of their goals with which they went to war. In fact, I don't even think they really were any goals. This was just an excuse for them to try and ethnic cleanse the people, which they have failed to do.
Right. Leith, welcome to the program. Very good to have you. Israel was stating, during this 15 months of genocide, was stating that the most clear and obvious goal was to dismantle Hamas. And that was a huge failure on Israeli side. Why do you think they failed to dismantle Hamas? And why don't they get the message?
They failed because the tactics of Hamas and the ability of the Palestinian people to absorb attacks by the Zionist colony are huge. And, of course, the Palestinian people are the indigenous people of the land. They have an attachment to their land and a will to fight because of that attachment that is not available for thieves and bandits like the Zionists as colonizers of our land, who can go anywhere in Europe and North America if they don't succeed in this battle. So this is the difference. The will of the Palestinian people has been unbroken for 100 years now of this ongoing genocide and attempt at colonizing Palestine. And because the Palestinian people up until now still hold on to the history that they inherited of thousands of years of fighting colonizers from the Romans to the Crusaders to the Mongol hordes to the French to the English, those are the anchors beyond the attachment that the Palestinians have to their land and their peoplehood that make it impossible for the Zionists and behind them the whole West to conquer Palestine.
Sakina, I'm going to borrow the terms from Leith, but the people are so attached to their homeland. Israel tried to destroy maybe 80% of all structures are ruined in Gaza. But at the same time, the moment the ceasefire was about to take place, and it did not take place for another 2 hours, but the moment it was supposed to come into effect, that we witnessed so many Gazan families trying to go back and return to their homes, homes that maybe were not there more. And what does that tell the Israeli campaign, the Israeli genocide?
You know, there were women that we were interviewing in Gaza, and this particular woman, I remember, a qualified pharmacist, her words have stayed with me. When we asked her, because she had qualified and had moved to Turkey to work over there, and then she said to us, Gaza is both a blessing and a curse on us. A blessing because, you know, it's the beautiful land where we find our souls, but it is a curse for us because we cannot leave it. Even when we have the option of making life elsewhere and we are successful, there is something that calls us back to Gaza. And I think this just amplifies and explains what it means to the indigenous people over there. No matter what you do to them, they have destroyed all the infrastructure. And when we see, you know, they are ready today. Another interview that we conducted, and we were asking these people, you are going back home. There is nothing there. There is only rubble. What are you going to? And they said, even on top of that rubble, if I can pitch a tent over there, this is the land I belong to. This was where my home is. So the attachment of Palestinians to their land, of course, given 75 years of being stolen from them, a homeland that is constantly at the threat of being taken away from them, that the connections are so deep that I think for the rest of the world, it's very hard to understand. And this is also the reason why we know that Israel is never going to win. Yes, they can keep on killing as many people as they want, and the barbarism they have shown in this recent genocide, I think, has really opened the eyes of the entire world. It's taken off the masks of the whole of the West when they were trying to make us believe that it was for the security of Israel. So this attachment and this love they have for land, but apart from that, I think it is also good to do with faith, because whenever we looked at them and there is any atrocities and any difficulty, they will hold up and say, God is enough for us. And this tells you that for people who have this resilience, for whom both life and death is a win, when they die, they believe they are going to heaven, and this is a martyrdom. How are you ever going to win against these kind of people? And so I think this is a very clear message to Israel. All they can do is they can destroy, they can kill people. They are never going to make these people go away from this land. And this is the reason why I believe it may take time, it may take more sacrifices. Definitely the genocide is over, but the occupation is not over. But a day will come when this land will be free, because the people of Palestine will not accept anything less.
Indeed. Leif, Israeli team at the negotiating table in Qatar several times disrupted the negotiations, maybe with the hope of getting a better deal. But this final ceasefire deal, is this the better deal Netanyahu was looking for?
Well, clearly, according to all the accounts, this deal that was signed is the same one that Biden presented almost 3 months ago, 13 months ago, and Hamas had agreed to it from that point. So there was no changes in the conditions that were on the table with the latest version that we see in front of us. All the declared goals of the Zionists, including the destruction of Hamas or the replacement of Hamas as in the who is governing the Gaza concentration camp, the disarmament of Hamas, the all of that was not achieved. And the Zionists have now exposed themselves to the world with the 14, 15 months of broadcasted genocide on all social media. They are now hated completely. There is no sane person on this planet that likes Zionism and Zionists and Israel. Israel is a rogue state that's now hated and going to be boycotted by everybody. And with it, the whole empire behind the Zionist colony has debased itself, destroyed 100 years of propaganda about democracy, human rights, women's rights, children's rights, animal rights, freedom of speech, freedom of the media. Those were all demolished by the empire itself to defend the Zionist colony. So even though the costs are huge. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, Lebanese, and others that have been martyred over the last 16 months to defend Gaza, even though that price is so huge, right now Israel has reached a point of no return. There's nothing that can save the Zionist colony except total, total genocide of not only the Palestinians, but everybody that stands against Zionism.
Right, Sakina, publicity-wise, the Israeli genocide also changed the face of Israel for many in the international community. We had, of course, the U.S. vetoes to protect Israeli rights, so-called rights there, and to stand against all the other countries in the UNSC. But at the same time, there are facts that cannot go back. It's a point of no return now. Because we had today, like, the UN General Secretary mentioning the fact that even the thought of annexing West Bank to Israel is inhuman, and that is absolutely unacceptable. So people who matter are taking the stances which are right. So what is Israel is going to do with this bad publicity right now at this moment?
I do agree that, you know, they have suffered massively in terms of their image and the publicity. But I'm also worried, you know, that, you know, the world sometimes has very short memory. And when the powerful nations decide, we saw how could 15, 16 months go about, you know, with people dying and being killed, and the world feeling sorry for them, yes, agreeing that this was a Zionist genocidal, you know, entity, and yet the world allowed it to happen. It allowed babies to be killed. It allowed women to suffer, to be raped. So despite the fact that, yes, the image is out there and everybody hates Israel, there is fear, because now that President Trump is in office, we don't know what were the takeaways and what were the agreements between him and Netanyahu. There are also discussions about when he was there in the previous term, his son-in-law was the one who engineered the Abrahamic Accords, and therefore there are probably discussions about resuming the Abrahamic Accords. Now these codes will be with the Arab countries. And we have seen huge failure from these Arab countries who are neighbors and brothers of Palestinians, but they weren't able to stop a genocide. So, I mean, I wouldn't be too surprised if they restarted building associations with Israel. They tried to, despite the fact that people know and understand what Israel is all about. Unfortunately, in this world, the imperialists, they rule. The colonialists, they rule the world. So whatever Africa thinks, whatever West Asia thinks, whatever those of us who are, you know, pro-truth and justice in the West believe, we don't have much say when it comes to the leadership and when it comes to the imperialist rulers. So, you know, I am a bit cautious. I'm optimistic with what has happened in Gaza. And this is a moment for us to take stock and take a breather and celebrate the win. However, you know, the occupation is not over. And for sure, it isn't going to be easy going forward, because they will fight tooth and nail until that freedom is achieved.
Well, at the same time, like Sakina said, Leif, Hamas's resilience has posed a serious challenge to the claim of success by Netanyahu and the limitations of military campaigns and genocidal wars on trying to make Hamas lose its power. Netanyahu cannot defend his policies. Even his own cabinet is cracking up with two ministers already resigning or threatening to resign. One of them, I'm sure, resigned. How does that tell us? You know, is this the end for Netanyahu now?
Well, look, Netanyahu is like a cat with nine lives. He is the prime minister that served the longest as prime minister of this Zionist colony since its creation, and he served as prime minister in three different decades now. So he is a maverick and you know, magician when in terms of playing the Zionist balance of power in the politics in the Zionist colony. And even if Ben-Gvir and Smoltrich leave, he will switch sides and move to the same groups that he was with anyways, like Lapid and Gallant and others that were part of his government before he brought in Ben-Gvir and Smoltrich. So ultimately, this does not mean the end of the political life of Netanyahu. In terms of the Zionist colony and the military battle that we witnessed over the last 16 months, it's very important that we all understand that the Zionist colony was militarily defeated on October 7th. And since that day, the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the whole axis of resistance were not fighting the Zionist colony. They were fighting the collective might of the empire, the Zionist empire, ruled from Washington, D.C. And in fact, the rush to have this ceasefire right now before the inauguration of Trump that just happened today was because all the components of the empire over the last 15 months were dedicated to maintaining the Zionist colony, and that overstretched the empire. If one of those components didn't work over the last 15 months, the Zionist colony would have ceased to exist. That includes something as small as the alternative supply route that the Emiratis, the Saudis, and the Jordanians provided to Israel to fill the gap for the Yemeni blockade on the Red Sea and the Sina Canal. So this is how much effort it took from the empire to even have a standstill, end of this war as we see today, where they were not able to defeat the resistance. So I imagine the future of the Palestinian struggle and the liberation of Palestine will depend on weakening components of the empire that were used over the last 15 months in this war to maintain the colony. Any one of those components, if we work as liberationists around the world to weaken, that will lead to the liberation of Palestine.
Right, Sakina, I'm going to take a different perspective now. Regarding the internal dynamics of Gaza, like the civilian support for Hamas, how did it affect Israel's failure in reaching its goals in Gaza?
Massively. I mean, if they were not supporting Hamas and if they were, for example, with the Palestinian Authority, we would not have seen the resolve and the resilience of the people of Gaza that we witnessed. And even now, you hear them saying that there is no chance that they will ever allow to be ruled by the Palestinian Authority, despite the fact that Mahmoud Abbas has kind of mentioned that possibility. So I think it is very clear that, and especially now, having gone through these genocide, you know, the people of Gaza have been strengthened in a way that is not believable. When you go through these kind of difficulties, you know, they say a light enters where the wound is, and they have had wounds all over. And therefore, now it's a time for the light to enter, and this light is going to strengthen them even further. But it isn't just limited, you know, to Gaza. The liberation of Palestine is, I think, it's a much bigger picture. So on one hand, as, you know, the other guest has mentioned, Israel is not actually the only entity. It is being run by Washington. It's the entire West collectively that have been supporting Israel. But then on the other side, when we talk about Palestine, again, it's not only Gazans. There is a whole of resistance, whether it's Lebanon, it's Iran, it's Iraq, it's Yemen. All of them played their role. And if we look at it, it was this collective support that did not allow Gaza to fall, did not allow Palestine to completely be wiped out. And now, going forward, we see a different picture emerging around the world, and especially when it comes to the Western hegemony. We've now got this deal, you know, between Iran and Russia. And on the other hand, Trump is very anti-European. He's anti-NATO. So on one hand, on the Western side, there might be further cracks between the collective West, and on the West Asian side, we see more unity, more coming together. So I think these matters will determine what happens, because Palestine and Israel are not fighting this war alone, and the occupation is not just by Israel. So the collective West, and how much they are able to address their own problems. The economy is really bad here. We have internal problems. We have dissatisfied citizens in the West, because they have also observed this genocide and are not accepting what their government has been complicit in sending arms. So I think all these matters going forward will further reveal the picture that Israel will lose support, whereas on the other side, I think more and more people are going to be with the Palestinians. But I don't think this is something we're looking at in a short term. And I really hope and pray that the world's memory is long enough to remember that now that the genocide will not be on our faces every single day on our phone, that we do not forget that the occupation is not over and that the rights of the Palestinians are still pending.
Right. We have just 1 minute left. Leif, what do you think the future holds now for Palestine and regarding the reconstruction and the role the international community is going to play in that?
You know, look, we are entering right now a very unstable time. It's very hard to predict either what the Zionist elite will do inside the colony and or the new emperor will do. We have just one more week to the ceasefire here in Lebanon. And, of course, by the end of February, we will see what's happening in Gaza. Otherwise, things are up in the air. We don't know any moment the Zionists could set the whole ceasefire on fire. And similarly, here in Lebanon, things can break out at any moment. And it will all depend, I guess, on what the new emperor, president, or whatever you want to call him, decides is going to happen. But things are going to move very fast, and by the end of the February, we may be in a new world.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to have you on the program. Leif Maruf, activist and political commentator, joining us from Beirut, and also Sakina Dutt, author, journalist, and producer, joining us from London.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This title given to the 11th Imam, Al-Askari, is because of a military camp.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hassan Al-Askari. When he gets there, he finds Imam moving towards a community who are anticipating him.
This is Dialogue, an introduction on the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari, alayhi salam, the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, was the 11th Imam of the Infallible Imams from the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. the blessed and pious Imam carried the banner of Islam, undertook the goals of the religion, and sacrificed his life unto this way. He was indeed a fountainhead of knowledge and wisdom. He faced many incredible difficulties and tragedies and hardships in order to spread and promote and keep intact the high values and goals of the religion of Islam. Truly, there are so many countless favors that have been bestowed upon the Muslims by the divinely appointed Imams, the infallible and immaculate Imams, including Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, the eminent and beautiful personality who is the 11th divinely appointed imam from amongst the 12 divinely appointed imams. Peace and blessings upon them all. So we're trying to go through this conversation that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam has with one of his companions. Of course, it is a kind of, it's relatively short conversation. It's not that it's a long conversation, but each and every single point has so many beautiful things to speak about that, you know, we're trying to take our time and really fully understand these conversations. And on the other hand, we find that we don't have a great many conversations from the 11th divinely appointed Imam, of course, because he lived in an era where the Shias and the Imam himself was under severe oppression, you know, imprisonment and surveillance and murdering of his companions and incarceration of his companions. And so the few conversations that we do have from Imam Askari alayhi salam, we really need to appreciate them and take our time and not necessarily rush through them. So we were talking about how Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, he gave some recommendations. He spoke about pardoning others, suppressing anger, to continuously associate with one's kin, the sila rahim, and to avoid qata rahim, this cutting off of associations with our kin. And we reached to a point where Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, he says that one should and one must comfort their brothers and sisters and try to carry out their needs in difficulty and at ease. So I'm not going to continue with some of the other recommendations. I'll leave that for the next episode. But this is something that is so incredibly important. It is necessary. And like we have said, these are one of those things that are the fundamental pillars, the fundamental aspects and attributes of Islam, this idea of being able to comfort our fellow Muslim brothers and sisters on one hand, and on the other hand, this idea and this fundamental principle that we should try our very best to carry out the needs of our brothers and sisters in their difficulty or in their ease. This is something that is, you know, really important. When we look at different places across the world where our Muslim brothers and sisters are truly suffering beyond imagination, whether it is Palestine or it is Lebanon or it is Syria or it is Iraq or it is Yemen, even in the Islamic Republic of Iran, due to these very cruel and inhumane sanctions, you know, or we see our brothers and sisters in Pakistan, in Parachinar, in Kashmir. These are our brothers and sisters that are really suffering, and they need our help, especially now in their time of difficulty. And this is a responsibility upon the shoulders of every single Muslim, is to help their fellow Muslim brothers and sisters. Of course, it might be difficult. Of course, it might take some effort. But this is something that we must do if we are to help one another become strong and to be able to stand up on our feet. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Askari alayhi salam.
Dialogue.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Very briefly, you know, Imam was born in Medina in the year 232 of the Hijrah. And his shahadat and wafat happened in Samarra. He was 28 years old. And during that time, the last 6 years was the period of his imamat. So his imamat era was very short, but very crucial, because this comes just at the before the beginning of the occultation and the ghibat of the imam of the present time. And just to look at the, you know, the situation at that time, the challenges that the 11th imam and even the 10th imam went through, how did they end up in Samarra? It was during the days of the 10th imam that one of the Khulafa of Banu Abbas by the name of Mutawakkil, he was known to be a person who was filled with hatred towards Ali and Ali Ali. He is considered to be somebody equivalent to Yazid. Banu Umayya, Mutawakkil would be in among Banu Abbas. And part of his plan was basically to keep a watch on the most prominent figure of the Ahlul Bayt, so the Imams of our times. And this is where he asked his officers actually to force the 10th Imam, Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi alayhi salatu wasalam, to move him from Medina to Samarra. And he was not, you know, brought alone. His family was with him. Initially they were settled in Baghdad, but in Baghdad there was still, you know, the population was very vast. This was the previous capital of Banu Abbas. And the circle of scholars and even the Shias there would still find their own ways to reach to the 10th Imam. And therefore, you know, even their stay in Baghdad was made very short, and they were moved from Baghdad to Samarra, which was the new capital of Banu Abbas. Especially they were placed in an area of the city which was actually a military camp. In Arabic, you would call, you know, this is the place of Askar. Askar means army.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
In the limelight.
Before the latest Zionist war of aggression against Gaza, the Israeli regime had frequently violated peace agreements with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, including the previous war in 2021. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. English website of Mehr News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. A historic ceasefire agreement took effect on Sunday morning, 19th of January, bringing to an end 15 months of relentless Zionist genocidal war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. However, serious doubts remain about the Tel Aviv regime's commitment to upholding the truce, given its long-standing pattern of disregarding agreements that require it to halt its attacks. In a televised speech on Saturday, 18th of January, a day before the much-anticipated truce came into effect, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed that the agreement was only temporary. He said U.S. President-elect Donald Trump emphasized to him that the ceasefire was temporary and that Israel would have the full backing of the incoming U.S. administration to resume the war. He further stated that Donald Trump has decided to lift all the remaining restrictions on U.S. munitions, allowing his regime to resume the war against Palestinians in Gaza with tremendous force. Netanyahu's remarks followed inflammatory comments by his ministers, including Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, both of whom are fiercely opposed to the ceasefire agreement with the Gaza-based Hamas movement. Bezalel Smotrich on Sunday threatened to overthrow the Netanyahu regime if it did not occupy the Gaza Strip, calling the ceasefire agreement a very serious mistake and a surrender to Hamas. It came after Itamar Ben-Gvir announced his party's withdrawal from the ruling coalition in Tel Aviv, which left Netanyahu with only 62 parliamentary seats in the 120-seat Knesset. According to experts, the ceasefire agreement has been described as the emphatic victory for the Hamas resistance movement in Gaza after 470 days of genocide. Between Wednesday, 15th of January, when the ceasefire deal was announced, and Sunday, 19th of January, when it came into effect, Israeli aggression in Gaza massacred over 120 Palestinians, including 32 women and 30 children. We continue with the Mehr News Agency's coverage of this story. In December 2024, the Israeli regime brazenly violated its 1974 agreement on disengagement with Syria, seizing a 266-square-kilometer demilitarized buffer zone along with additional Syrian territories to the east of the occupied Golan Heights, areas designated after the October 1973 war. For years, Tel Aviv covertly supported terrorists in that region, supplying them with weapons and medical assistance. But when Bashar al-Assad's democratically elected government in Damascus collapsed, the Tel Aviv regime abruptly labeled those very groups as dangerous terrorists and occupied more Syrian territory. By taking control of 10 crucial dams, their reservoirs and the valleys of 3 strategically significant rivers, Tel Aviv appears to be advancing its long-standing strategy of plundering foreign water resources, simultaneously undermining the 1974 water agreements with Jordan. In neighboring Lebanon, since 27th of November, when a ceasefire agreement with the Hezbollah resistance movement was brokered, the Israeli regime has already violated it more than 500 times, leaving over 30 martyred and more than 40 wounded. During a high-level meeting with the United Nations Secretary-General Antonio Guterres on Saturday, 18th of January, Lebanon's newly elected president, Joseph Aoun, condemned the continued Israeli attacks on Lebanon's border villages, declaring them to be in direct violation of the ceasefire agreement terms. Israeli aggression on Lebanon has also drawn sharp criticism from United Nations Undersecretary-General for Peacekeeping Operations, Jean-Pierre Lacroix, who described the situation as fragile. Lacroix said the Israeli occupation forces must withdraw immediately from the Lebanese territory and acknowledge Lebanon's full commitment to the ceasefire agreement. The agreement requires the Zionist occupation troops to withdraw from the bordering Lebanese villages and territories within 60 days, or by 27th of January. However, despite international calls, this has not yet been fully implemented. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in the occupied Palestinian territories, during the week-long humanitarian pause in late November 2023, the Israeli regime carried out at least 3 violations. On the penultimate day of the pause, they opened fire in the north of Gaza City, martyring 2 people, and on the last day, renewed shooting and shelling by the Israeli Navy was reported. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Before the latest war of aggression against Gaza, the Israeli regime had frequently violated peace agreements with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, including in the previous war in 2021. The two sides signed an agreement on 20th of May 2021, and within a month, the Israeli regime violated the agreement twice, first on 16th of June, when the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza was bombed, then again on 18th of June, when Beit Lahia was targeted in the Gaza Strip. Even earlier, in 2012 and in 2014, the Tel Aviv regime repeatedly violated the peace agreements it signed with Hamas after the wars of those years. Out of 191 documented Israeli violations, 10% resulted in death and 42% in injuries or detentions, while there were no Israeli casualties in subsequent Palestinian retaliatory strikes. The deadly 2008 war was also the result of Israeli violation of a ceasefire agreement on 19th of June that year, after which Hamas did not fire a single rocket or grenade for 5 months, and it restrained other resistance groups from doing the same. On the other hand, the Israeli regime did not ease the siege of the Gaza Strip as at the time it had committed to under the agreement, and then in 4th of November that year, it brazenly broke the ceasefire by carrying out an invasive operation in which 6 Palestinians were martyred. The Israeli military concluded Hamas likely wanted to continue the ceasefire despite the raid. In other words, their belief was that they would break the truce agreement by expecting the other side to stick to it. The hypothetical assumption proved wrong as resistance movements immediately fought back, to which Tel Aviv responded with a brutal war, massacring 1,400 Palestinians, including around 700 to 900 civilians and 288 children. A United Nations fact-finding mission known as the Goldstone Report concluded that the Israeli wartime goal was to punish, humiliate and terrorize a civilian population in Gaza. Eventually, an agreement was reached and the war ended, but the Israeli regime continued to violate it through attacks, massacring and wounding of dozens of Palestinians until the next larger aggression in late 2012. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas made peace offers in 1988, 1997 and 2004 for a multi-year ceasefire on the condition that Tel Aviv recognizes Palestine and accepts the return of Palestinian refugees to their homeland, offered by Mahmoud al-Zahar, Sheikh Ahmad Yassin and Abdulaziz al-Rantisi respectively. Sheikh Ahmad Yassin proposed to the Israeli officials the idea of a ceasefire for 30 years, and Abdulaziz al-Rantisi proposed a 10-year truce in return for Israel's withdrawal and the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. The Israeli regime ruled out the possibility of recognition of an independent Palestine and return of Palestinian refugees, continuing its aggressive policies and plunder, killing the latter two Hamas resistance leaders in separate attacks in 2004. This time, again, serious doubts remain about the Tel Aviv regime's commitment to upholding the truce agreement, not because of Hamas, but because of the illegitimate Zionist regime's unquenchable thirst for blood.